Last time we talked about God's holiness, and excuse me, what I didn't get into was how that kind of has something to say about God's justice, where if what we're trying to determine of what does God's holiness imply about his relation to us, part of that is going to be that he will, because he is pure, because he is, you know, in the terms of humans, when we say we're holy, we mean in some sense set apart, and usually by some purpose, by God or for God, or for God's purposes. God obviously is going to kind of set the purpose. So what does holiness or purity mean for him? Well, really, maybe one of the things we mean by saying God is holy or pure is that he is without sin. Now, if we define sin as something like doing something other than God's will, then that's kind of a little bit circular, that it's whatever he wills is not sin just because of the fact that he wills it. So you'll remember this took us into the Euthyphro dilemma, where we talked about the two horns of, is it good because God wills it, or does God will it because it's good? And what we had said was the resolution was that it's a false dichotomy, and that God wills it because it's in accordance with who he is, with his own nature. Now, I think there's something to be said, and this is maybe not terribly well codified to my knowledge in theology or philosophy here, but I wonder sometimes whether God's essential traits, the things that he chooses, the things that he is, if any of those essential traits can be things that he wills himself to be. So I think the easy answer to that, the obvious apparent answer to that one is no. If it's something that's essential, it's something that's kind of foundational to who God is, and so he can't choose to make himself something like that. Now, that, of course, raises the question of, well, does God get to will whether or not he loves people, or is he kind of made to do so by his own nature? So someone may try to push you back into the Euthyphro by saying, well, if God doesn't choose to be all-loving, then even God doesn't have free will. He's forced to love people. So I want to say that God is not forced to love people. That I think what happens is that God gets to make the choice of whether to create people at all. And doing so knowing that he, as an all-good, all-pure God, if he creates people, he will love them. So he gets to choose whether he has an object of love or not. I think that's okay, in the same way that you wouldn't say that you're a bad parent by saying, can you, when you have children, can you choose to love them? You might say something like this: well, if I'm really a good parent and I choose to have children, then I'm not going to get the option to be like, well, if I don't like that one, I'll just give them the boot because I don't have to love them. You're going to say, I'm kind of going to be stuck by in wanting to be a good parent in loving them no matter what. But if you say to yourself, well, I don't even want to put up with, what happens if I have a child who's just a terrible, terrible human being, and I would have been absolutely sorry that I ever had them as a child, and you can't get past that, and you can't, and you say, that's too much of a risk, I don't want to do that, I will be too sad, or I just don't want to deal with it, then what you can do is say, well, then I'm just not going to have children, and you don't have to worry about that one. So we'll talk more about this in the future, but I just mean to bring it up as an additional point to what we talked about last time. And then I also wanted to point out, we can have more of a discussion on this one if you wish. We don't have to. But one of the questions that a lot of people ask, and there are not anybody in this room that I consider atheist or skeptical of faith, period. So those are the people who usually have a problem with it. What does God's purity, God's justice, say about what morality will be? So maybe this is more for a question for Skylar, because I know Sky has thought a lot on the margins and where the boundaries lie on these kinds of things. So maybe I'll really just pose it as a question to you. If what we're going to say is, if what we're going to say is something like this, for men at least, for men and women, God's commands for us become moral obligations, and so he may issue some set of commands like don't kill each other. You know, rule number five or six, don't kill each other. But then he may turn around and say, all right, Eric is going to be appointed an executioner. And so if God says to Eric, because Scott did this evil thing, take him outside the community and stone him, Eric, you're the guy who's going to throw the stones, something that otherwise would have been wrong outside of God's command becomes a moral duty for Eric. Eric doesn't have the authority at that point. He doesn't have the moral authority to say, no, I'm not going to do that, because the source of the authoritative command was God. So he gets to set the penalty if he wants to, etc. I know this is a long question, but if you take it all the way back to the idea of, well, it's God that gave people life, so does he have the right to take it away? We might say something like, yes. I want to say there's one other binding on it that says God can give life and take it away if he wants to, unless he handcuffs himself in such a way that he can't do so. So if he says something like this, I'm going to give Eric life, and he has, and now Eric, God will not take it away. I commit to not taking it away, unless Eric kills Lang or somebody else. In which case, I will take it away, and that I reassert my right over that life. So I think God has done that. He has said to people, "I'll let you live unless you disobey me, or maybe even certain commands, or I'll let you live a certain length of years unless you disobey certain commands or something like that." So if some people have some problems with this and say, no, you should never be allowed to do so. If God wants somebody dead, he has to kill them. So maybe question one would be, do you think that it's consistent? Because this is a consistency argument people have with Christians is, here's your all-loving God who says to do these things, this is justice, and then he also says to do these things, which seems bad. So he says, don't kill, but at the same time he says, this guy did something bad, so kill him. Is that okay? Do you have any thoughts before we go further on?
Yeah, I think that's a strong counter from a atheist agnostic perspective, especially when it comes to things like the death penalty. I think more so than like just war, I think that's a separate scenario. But when you, if you truly believe that as a Christian, you have to be willing to accept that the state is encroaching on the sovereignty of God when it takes human life under the death penalty. And you have to reconcile that, because as Christians, we believe that that is God's sovereignty to own human life and to take human life. So, I mean, if you want to say, look, the separation of church and state, I can accept that. But as a Christian, I think Christians should struggle with the death penalty pretty profoundly.
I have, and then right over here. So I didn't plan on bringing this up, but I have had a thought for many years that I'm very curious as to whether or not the death penalty, as administered by one human to another, is not the result of the fall and post-fall stuff even. So if nations are going to emerge, and what we're going to do is we're going to set a border, we're going to build a wall, we're going to draw a line, or we're going to identify as a group and say, this is the United States of solid ground, or whatever, and we say, we're a sovereign nation, and... By saying we're a sovereign nation, what we also are saying is, you people over there, whoever you are, or you people everywhere, don't get to tell us what to do. And if we're going to say we're a sovereign nation and we don't have God as our leader, Skylar is going to be our leader, then what we're really saying is we're handing all that kind of authority to Skylar. So the question is, in the formation of a nation, you get to pick who you're going to give the authority to in some way. So when God was the sole person in charge and somebody killed somebody else, what was the penalty? It wasn't capital punishment. He put a mark on Cain and said, you have to go away from here and people will know what you have done. And then Cain says, this punishment is too great for me because anybody who finds me will kill me. And he says, I will put a mark on you so they know. Cain will be avenged sevenfold for anybody that kills him. Okay, that's an interesting point. Why didn't, it seems easy. Life for life, Cain kills Abel, God kills Cain. or he has Adam kill Cain, but he doesn't do that. Now, of course, when we set up under Moses, a lot of times we think of, I have historically thought of the Jewish nation under Moses as a theocracy. God tells them what to do, and they do it. But it wasn't really a theocracy. It was close. Yeah, so it was Moses was the leader of the nation, and he was getting his guidance from God. And it was the Lord who led them, but it wasn't the Lord who was ruling them. In the same way that in the garden, God, maybe you could say God was leading them, but in the garden, everybody was acknowledging God as the sovereign. In the Exodus time, not everybody was acknowledging God as sovereign. We want you to appoint judges over, you know, we need judges appointed over us, or we need people to do whatever. Now, God told Moses, set up these judges. But the bottom line is, when you look in Jewish history, when you hear them talking about it, or even when you hear Jesus talk about it, he doesn't say, when someone says, then why did Moses give us direction to do X? He doesn't say, because God knows your heart, you know, your heart is hard, and so God wanted it this way. What he said was, this is derivative of something that Moses was doing kind of as a leader. So I wonder, and they framed it in that question, why did Moses say, give people a certificate, give your wife a certificate of divorce? So it wasn't, why did God say, give your wife a certificate of divorce? So I'm curious about whether or not in the way God was running things, that even things that we consider capital crimes today might not be capital crimes. Now, under the second covenant, under the Mosaic covenant, that it's very clear what the duties are. And so if you go back to this idea of, well, if God orders it and he tells the executioner to do this, it's now a moral duty for the executioner. So I think it sounds like we're in agreement on that one. Now the question is this, and this he made a reference to it. Oh, let's go over to the other question.
Keep going.
No? Okay. Sorry about that. If we have a question about capital punishment, the harder, in some ways, question is, what about something like, maybe we would call the moral worst-case scenario for people who are critical of the Bible. I think the one that gets brought up most frequently is, you send in the Israelites into Canaan, and it was kill everything. Men, women, children, goats, chickens, earthworms that were pets, whatever it was. It was everything. Does God have the... People will say, how can God do this? Not that they wouldn't say God has the authority to do so, because if you're assuming that God makes it all and that the makers can do whatever, then they can do so. The question is it consistent? Is it consistent for God to tell the Israelites, go in there and kill babies? That's the question. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think it is.
Okay, and why?
I struggle with it because it is not what we see evidenced in God's behavior in most other places in the Bible. Now, the delineations between the Old and New Testament, and some issues there, but in general, the idea of a vengeful, wrathful, genocidal God that does not do their own dirty work is
right.
Really hard.
Now, does God do his own dirty work on some occasions, so to speak?
Sure.
And right, so Sodom and Gomorrah, you know...
Yeah. That, to me, is God taking his own action. You know, I'm going to wipe out the world in a flood. Sodom and Gomorrah. There's many examples, which makes the exceptions stand out.
Even more so. Yes. Yeah.
Where he tells the Israelites, wipe out this people and their livestock and everything.
So this is a very interesting point because, like Skylar's pointing out, oftentimes the critic of God's consistency and morality doesn't raise Sodom and Gomorrah or the flood, because everything died in both of those cases too. Everything from little babies to goats and sheep as well. So why do they not criticize him on that case? And I think there are two reasons. One is the underlying assumption is something like this. The Israelites didn't actually get that command from God. This is nationalism run amok, and they just invented it in their own, you know, God told me to go to JMU. No, he didn't. You just wanted to go to JMU and then you used God as a justification for it. God wanted me to take this land over. No, he didn't really. You're just using him as a justification for it. Or he wanted me to kill all these people or whatever. So that's one, is there's an assumption that many of them build in, many critics of this position build in, saying it's probably not really a command from God. The other one is something like, if knowing that God can do it himself, knowing that God has done it himself in the past, and in fact did it to Israel himself, opening up the ground and sending snakes and whatever else, why would he have the Israelites do it? The moral command theorist, now the moral command theorist is somebody who's, divine command theorist, excuse me, is somebody who says, when God gives a command, that command is righteous, that command is good, or that command is a moral obligation for the person who's doing it. When God tells you to do something, you have to do it. And their point is actually flows naturally out of what Skylar just said. The pity, if there's any to be given, is actually more to the executioner than it is to the victim, because the victim was being had either earned it or often the divine command theorist says, well, what about the little kids? Well, the little kids not being yet morally culpable, it's actually a mercy to them, because instead of growing up and being evil, they die and go to heaven, smirking on behalf of the back row. Understandably so, if your assumption is this is nationalism run amok, right? If not, we've got the same question about babies dying in utero, miscarriages, early infant deaths, all that kind of stuff. Same point there. But if you come back and you say we ought to pity the executioner, then some people who have said this then, of course, get hard criticism from the other side when they say something like, poor Israeli soldiers who had to kill the babies. And, of course, the other side of the argument is going to go up and be like, how can you say that? That's morally reprehensible to even say, feel sorry for the baby killer here. And the answer is, well, it depends on where you think moral authority comes from. Now, we're throwing mud in the water to some degree, or questions in the water that aren't necessarily there to clarify. They're there to show how difficult this is to answer. But what I would suggest to you, and we can get into this if you want to now, or we can do this later, but what I would suggest to you is the resolution for it will never be found at the highest level. You have to trace your own belief about where moral authority comes from down to its source, and then run the argument from the assumption. And when you do that, you come away with either God has the right to do so, and it works out a certain way, or God doesn't have the right to do so, and if he doesn't have the right, then who does have the right? And now you're into a question about whether morality is objective or not. And if you decide to question whether morality is objective, or to make an argument for the objective grounding of morality in something other than God, nobody's done it yet. So somebody's got to do that.
Is the question, is it moral for God to have to kill people, is it moral for God to have the Israelites kill people?
I think it's the question of to have the Israelites kill people, because maybe both. So on the one side, if you say the superficial analysis from a skeptical side is, you're telling me God loves people, but God also kills people. Now, I love my babies. I'm not going to kill my babies, and surely I'm not better than God. Your theology is inconsistent, or your philosophy is inconsistent, or your moral theory is inconsistent. So that's the superficial level analysis, and it sounds compelling when you ask the question that way. So the answer to that one is, well, yeah, you wouldn't kill your child unless your one child is about to kill your other child, and there was no way to do it other than A, B, or C. Now, I think the other part that's very important there, that when we get into God's love portion, we'll read some verses that have to do with it. But there's another assumption in here that almost the entire world that's talking about this forgets, and frequently the Christian forgets, which is, this is not the end. This life is a fluttering second of an eternity. And so if you say to yourself, well, no, see, this is a final and an irrevocable penalty. Capital punishment cuts it off. No, it doesn't. Capital punishment doesn't stop eternity from happening. In fact, we can go back and read it, but I'll just mention it, but if anybody wants to. Do you remember on one of the first conquering missions in Canaan, everything is supposed to be devoted to destruction. They go through, they wipe everything out, and then all of a sudden they go get their rear ends kicked by the next group. And the question is, why are we getting beat? And they go inquire of the Lord, and he says, you haven't obeyed my commands. And so they draw lots to say who didn't obey the command, and they land eventually on this tribe, this sub-tribe, and a guy named Achan. And Achan says, that's right. I saw this silver bar, maybe. I can't remember what all he found, but basically some treasure and some nice cloth or something like that. And he was like, it was just too nice. I had to keep it. Now, Achan and his family get taken outside and stoned to death. They're all killed. And you might say to yourself, well, that guy's not saved. He goes to hell as a result. I don't think that that's the case. I think what you saw was, you know, if you are an Israelite and you go do this thing and it makes you ceremonially unclean, you don't go to hell. What you do is you go to the temple, you go offer this sacrifice, and you are cleansed of your sin. And now you don't go to, you know, we're talking in terms of heaven and hell. Salvation, let's talk about it in terms of salvation. And if that's the way that salvation was kind of covenantally worked, then that's what cleans you of your sin. For the capital punishment, what cleans you of your sin, sometimes you came and you gave grain. Sometimes you came for sin offering. It was another animal. Another blood had to be spilt in order to do that. And then eventually, the question was, by giving your own blood, if you do so willingly, as acknowledging that you were guilty and this was sin, what you're ultimately saying is, I'm not rebelling against God. I acknowledge that what I did here was wrong and deserves the ultimate penalty, and I submit to the ultimate penalty. I think you can make a case for, you know, if Achan tried to fight his way out of it and gets killed, okay, well, he was rebelling against God. But if he says, yep, that's right, I did the wrong thing, I'm going to die, and he submits to that penalty, gives glory to God, and dies, what prevents him from going to heaven? Nothing. David, right? Same thing. David does something worthy of death. What are Nathan's words to him after he tells the parable? God has put away your sin. You will not die. So what he says is, we should drag you outside the assembly and stone you, but for whatever reason God has said in your case, I'm not going to do that. David's just as guilty as Achan. The fact that they execute Achan and didn't execute David, no difference. No difference. The difference how far God's mercy went in that case. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I think one of the scariest verses in the Bible to me, that it kind of ties God's Old Testament, you know, justice and anger in with the New Testament, is when a bunch of people come to ask Jesus, you know, what about the blood that, let's see, what was it? It was like, there were two things. There was a tower that fell and killed people, and then there was blood of Galileans that Pilate mixed with the sacrifices or something like that.
Right.
And Jesus, I mean, Jesus' response is incredible to me, where he says, well, unless you repent, you too will perish. And so, and I think it was R.C. Sproul I was listening to, and he said this, that people marvel at God's justice, and, you know, we marvel, wow, how does he allow so much pain and suffering in the world? But what we should be marveling at is that we're not all consumed.
Yeah, we are not all dead yet. Yeah, this is an example of God's mercy, and the Canaanites, to me, are the greatest example of that one, which is, I mean, they were already unspeakably wicked at a particular time, but what God said is, the iniquity of the Canaanites is not yet fulfilled. Not like I've got this quota and I just want to see if they can hit it, but more like, my patience is such that I will let these guys get as bad as they can possibly get before they cross this point of no return, and then, all right, we got to destroy this whole thing.
I mean, it's, you know, we're not on good standing with God. Was it Jonathan Edwards, the sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, where we are like a spider that's dangling over a furnace, and, you know,
by a thread
is God's mercy.
Yes, yeah, and I think ultimately, well, you've heard my kind of thoughts on why this world is what it is, but part of it is, if you don't see consequences of sin in here, you know, if God is loving, in the same way that we as loving parents, you don't want to helicopter parent the whole time, because at some point they're going to get away from you, so to speak. Now, you might say, well, nobody gets away from God. But what if the idea is you want to let people have their own space to do things, then how do you expand that space? How does an almighty, omniscient, all-powerful God give people the kind of freedom that you want to give to somebody who loves you? So imagine a perfect, I mean, if you want to really get bent about it, imagine a perfect husband who can tell his wife exactly everything that'll make her happy, and he's right. And let's say he's flawlessly right. He's always right about it. And so if every time she's about to do something, he's like, whoa, hang on, that's not going to make you happy. Why don't you do it this? At some point, the wife's going to say, I don't feel like I have any level of freedom here at all. You got to let me be. You might even hear this. You'll hear this from kids all the time. I need to be free to make my own mistakes. And the loving parent is like, for the love of Pete, why on earth would you want to make mistakes? And the answer back to that is sometimes you can't comprehend what right looks like, how good right is, how nice right is, until you've seen wrong. An analog of this one is the meme, "This is a first world problem." You don't know what pavement is until you've gone to a third world and said, "This is how it is," without, you know, all the stuff being. I remember every time I came back from overseas back in the day, I would step out of the car or the plane or whatever else and be like, "This is amazing! Look at the pavement. It's not even cracked for like 200 yards. This is unbelievable. It's practically a miracle. Look at the grass. I can't believe we have grass everywhere." You know, in parts of the Middle East, we go to Dubai, the ultimate show of status is the fact that there are lawns out in front of some of these hotels or wherever. And it's a small, it'll be a lawn this big. But the fact that you can water it enough that in 120 degree direct sunlight, it doesn't die. I mean, you are the heat. You are the
guys taking care of it.
Yeah, and there's seven dudes, yeah, with scissors on the edge. Yeah. So that's showing off to the nth degree. So I come back to America, I'm like, "This is amazing." how does this happen? Until you touch the third world, until you build in the third world, until you interact with the third world, you cannot appreciate the first world if you spent the whole time in the first world. He who has been forgiven much loves much, and he who has been forgiven little loves little. If God wants to inspire love to us, then by letting us be free, not only does he help us out with our own freedom, we get to see the consequences of our own sin, which he does bound sometimes. So sometimes we're like, why doesn't God step in? He does. Got bad enough in Sodom, wiped the place out. Got bad enough on the whole earth at one point, wiped the thing out with a flood. Got bad enough in Canaan, wiped it out with the Israelites. We're just discussing the morality of that one. Got bad enough in Israel, opens up the ground and contains the evil. So at some point when the virus gets too bad, so to speak, he does step in. But he lets us be as free as we would want to be if we were the wife or the husband that the other person could be controlling, or the son or the daughter that the parents could be controlling, or whatever else.
So are you saying that you need to have evil so that you can see how good good is? Because I would disagree with that.
I'm not saying that that's the case. I'm saying for people, if you're an all-knowing being like God, then you already know this without having to do or see or observe any of that. It's knowledge that you already possess because you possess all logically possible to possess knowledge. If you are a limited being who doesn't have all knowledge, then this is something that you don't necessarily possess. So this is where you have to put, this is where the faith thing comes in, and you'll remember, I refer you back to the comments about the garden of, you know, I think the knowledge of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil wasn't evil in and of itself. The only reason it was wrong to eat it was God said, in fact, God did say, "Do not eat of the tree," but he told them why. And the bottom line is the why is containment. Note what God said there was, what he said was, if you go and know these things, then basically I'm going to lay a set of containment on you that you don't have right now. And the containment is going to be your life is going to have is now going to be finite instead of infinite. And then afterwards he says, let's prevent them from getting the tree of life because then they'll live forever. And the implication is this evil will continue and multiply and get worse, and then we can't shut it off. Or will not shut it off because we've made that agreement. So no, I'm not saying that you have to see it, but I'm saying limited beings, in order to appreciate these things, have to some of them have to experience it. So you'll remember my whole problem of evil proposed solution was something like some people don't need to see it, and they're maybe the babies that die in infancy, maybe, I don't know. Some people do need to see it and feel it. I think that's believers. Some people, whether they see it or not, are always going to rebel. I think those are the vessels of wrath that freely choose to do that and will always freely choose to do that. So I think it depends on the limited being, but an unlimited being does not have to do that. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I'll have to think about that soon.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up comment? No? Okay.
I'm practicing listening.
Oh, gosh. I'm out of practice at that myself. Skylar, next point. Anything on that? Okay. I'll at least throw out there, we can discuss this later at some time, especially when we get to doctrine of man type of stuff, of if God commands it, then it's a moral duty, and it may be hard. And for those who have been in war or have been policemen or have been maybe even firemen or EMTs and stuff that have to deal with graphic death, some of which you bring about, some of which your failure to be sufficiently skillful might might allow, all these kinds of difficult life and death things. This gets you rapidly develop one of three things: a moral theory, amorality, or PTSD. There's just no, there's not much middle ground in there, because it just makes it very, very real for you. And so consider these things outside of having to have that experience, and I think one can do that. But what I would say is always draw down, you know, maybe to your point about Jesus saying, people asking him, what about the people whose bloods were mixed with the sacrifice? What about the folks who the tower fell on? They were basically saying, here's a complex, trying to write with the eraser, it's not working. Here's a complex set of questions out here. They have interactions, you know, that may go this way. Where is the foundation for this stuff? And, you know, how do you ground this moral theory? And Jesus probably could have had an excurse, and, you know, here's the ground of this moral theory and how it works, and here's how you explain all of them. Jesus gave what I'll call, for those of us who know C.S. Lewis decently, which is probably most people, he gave Aslan's answer. He could have done an excursus for an hour and been like, all right, let's lay out the moral theory. Here's why it works. Here's what. But he basically said this: I don't tell people their other people's stories. I tell them their own story. So what he said was, they were asking, what about these guys? And Jesus said, what about you? When you understand your own moral obligations, when you understand why you have to obey God, you will be at the foundation. And when you reason from the foundation forward, things fall into place. It's the reason we're doing this doctrine of God stuff. You cannot, and doctrines of Christianity, people always want to rush to the end and say, explain to me how this works. And you say, you can't even understand it until you get rid of the wrong ideas in your head and you understand the right ones. The math or science answer to this would be something like this: explain to me how it is that ice melts like this. And the answer to why ice melts the way it melts, right now, the only way we know how to model it is using partial derivatives, which are calculus-based mathematics and models that are difficult to understand. So if you want to say, just explain ice to me in a way that I can predict how it melts, the answer to that is, well, you got to learn addition and subtraction first, and then you got to learn geometry, and then you got to learn algebra, and then you got to learn how to do some sort of calculus, and then you got to understand vectors and vector addition, and then you got to understand partial derivatives, and then you got to understand a little bit about thermodynamics and this kind of stuff. And by the time you mix all these together, when you understand those things, you can look at a block of ice and be like, and in your mind, you can watch it melt, and then when it melts, it happens almost just like you said that it did. That kind of knowledge, that kind of complex, and this complexity here that everybody wants to just know, tell me how the ice melts, you got to do the fundamentals first, and you got to reason in a certain way to get there. Morality is no different. Righteousness is no different. The knowledge of God is no different. You have to work from firm foundations. You can't adopt your theology first and then go back and try to justify it. That's why we're doing this project. That's my belief about why we're doing things the way we're doing. All right, other questions before we move on to my favorite topic? Yes.
I would say that, you know, you kind of separated Jesus' answer. I think he did answer their question. I mean, I think their question was essentially, how is God just? How can this be right? And I think he's, you know, gave very specific, you know, it's for all, it applies to all of us, but, you know, his answer was basically, well, they deserve it they deserve death just as you deserve death.
Yeah, but I think in doing so, he is taking him back to here, which is, you know, their question may be, I think their question may have been deeper than what we look at it on the surface, or at least if I was asking that question at the time, I would have been thinking a few things in that answer. And so I think the answer of it matters about you is that the answer to both of them is the same, as you're pointing out, but that instead of saying, I'm going to explain why this particular guy, you know, it mixed with blood. Now, there's a law about blood, and anybody whose blood is done like this, you know, is assumed to be under a curse. Why were these guys under a curse? Because at the time, it didn't seem like they did anything wrong. In fact, it seemed like they were doing the right thing. And, you know, here he is working his way back through the whole answer, and the answer is back to you. I mean, it's to me, it's the same answer as, okay, whoever's without sin, cast the first stone. He's not saying the woman was not deserving of death. We know the woman was deserving of death. It was caught in the act, right? Not a question of witnesses, not a question of whatever, and the death penalty was authorized at the time for that. In fact, it was commanded. It was a moral obligation of those people at that time. And what Jesus said is, yeah, by all means, fulfill the moral obligation. If you are willing to have that moral obligation fulfilled against you as well. And then people are like, well, if I'm going to hold everybody to that standard, then people are going to start, there'll be a rock fight by the time this is all over, right? So your point is valid, I think, but I still think he's doing, maybe he's doing both, but I see it in mostly in terms of this. Okay. Yes, sir.
So I think, I mean, for me, the fundamental disconnect that I think that you haven't brought up is the different rules for God's society versus God's individuals. And, you know, I think that, you know, we are called to, you know, live in a society and obey the rules, and if the, you know, certain rules for the society are given that way, and then if society's rule is to execute somebody, there has to be an executioner.
Right.
And that's not murder, therefore it's not, you know, against the commandment, because there's no intent, you know, an evil intent. But I think that God, you know, so, you know, this is not theocracies, right? I think God wants us to have Christian societies, whether you call them a nation or it's just a group of people in a small area, because not everybody is a, you know, super warrior of Christ who can take the slings and arrows of the barbarians. Some people need support of other people around them. So God's mercy and love says that, you know, those people need to be in Christian societies, therefore, so that they can prosper.
Yes, yeah.
And so, you know, it's not a theocracy. It can be as small as a small group, or it can be as big as a nation. But those rules for societies are different than the rules for people.
Yes. No, and I'm with you on that one. When we get to society, Jesus told us what the minimum size of the kingdom was. Where two of you are gathered in my name, there I am also. So you want the king to be there? All you need is two of you. Now, it's interesting that he doesn't say, but he also elsewhere says, wherever you go, you know, in the whole world, I am with you. But there's something special about, and I think he says, on the individual side, I'm always there. But when you are, two of you are gathered in my name, in the name of the king, that is the small as the society. Now it's a society. It's a society of two, whose job is now to live as the king says. So if you're gathered in the name of the king, you can't be gathered in the name of Christ and do unchristian things. Then you're saying you're gathered in the name of the king, but you're not really. Being gathered in the name of Christ, the Messiah or the king, is to say, here we are together obeying the orders of the king. That, a family ought to be that. But the interesting thing is a family is no different than two other non-blood related people. Everybody's blood related, right? Two other non-immediately blood-related people next to each other. I mean, why do we draw the circle around nuclear family? In America, we draw it around nuclear family. In the Middle East, they draw it around everybody. In fact, everybody's a cousin. And basically, if you're the same general race, you're all cousins in some way. Technically, we're all cousins and aunts and uncles anyway, and in some sense. So, at, you know, great X times removed. So on a societal side, you got to ask the question of what is your society founded on? And to your point, that minimum society of two is what the kingdom can be. And the bigger it is, the more powerful it can be too.
It would be immoral for the society to let murderers continue to murder.
Yes.
It was immoral for the Israelite society to let the people who they were commanded to kill to prosper and continue, because then it is stealing from the future of the Israelite society that God has laid out for them.
Yes. Now, so, I'm sorry, go ahead. No, I would say also on to his point, even under the New Testament, we keep talking about Israel, but under the New Testament, in the kingdom, the same kingdom I've been talking about, God did not take a pass on his justice and purity. In fact, if anything, God ramped up the level of, by the way, if you're serious about being in the kingdom, this is how honest you need to be. What happens like early on in Acts, like immediately in Acts after Pentecost, right after the church is formed, right after the Holy Spirit's been given, we're talking about what sounds like days, weeks, or months afterwards. Ananias and Sapphira, Everybody's and the church has just been established, and everybody's holding their property in common, given as each person needs. If they got something, they'll sell it and bring it in. This guy brings it in, and he lies about how much he gave because he wants to chest thump a little bit and say, look how much I'm doing. And Peter's like, you haven't lied to God, you lied to the Holy Spirit. And he gives him another chance. Did you sell it for this amount? Yep. Same thing. His wife, the same thing. Achan and his wife die relatively early on in the, and kids die early on in the Israelite community. There's a parallel in Acts. Ananias and Sapphira are dead at the word of Peter right off the bat. And what was the next verse? And great fear gripped the whole church. Right? And we're like, well, wait a second. Fear's bad. Now, I meant to say this. We'll get into love kind of thing later, but I'll just put this up here and to talk about in a bit. Clearly, we're going to go into the next time on love, which is good because this is my favorite topic. I'd rather be multi-time.
And I'm probably belaboring this too much, but I think it's interesting that back to the whole, you know, executioner, the executioner who's following God's will. David was, you know, he followed God's will to the letter, and he killed, you know, so many Philistines. You know, David has slain his 10,000s. And that was, he was being obedient to God. But I think it's interesting that God did not let David build the temple because there was too much blood on his hands.
Yeah, now the question is, in my mind, is why did he not let him build the temple? Was it because the blood on his hands tends to imply like guilt. Was it because of Uriah? Was it because of something else? Yeah, I don't know. But I will admit that my intuition leads the way that you're suggesting here. I do think that God says things like, look, sometimes I make warriors, but like, I'm not saying medieval society was the way to do it, but there were the, you know, they had three orders of society. The highest order was not the nobles. The highest order were the priests. The second highest order were the nobles, and the third were the warriors. So the warrior, even though we're like, you know, we like warriors in our society, they're the lowest caste of the three kind, and then there's a caste below it, which are, it's those who pray, those who fight, and those who work basically. But the workers were divided into nobles and knights who worked for the nobles kind of thing. So yes, to your point, it may be the case that even as great as we think of David being, he was still a warrior, and a warrior's not a priest. So now Jesus unites them in this idea of priestly king, which David was too. He was kind of the first type of that one. And maybe Melchizedek was the first type of that one, but you see the point, and I think that's a valid point. Okay. By all means. In fact, let's stay on this topic for a bit because we're clearly not going to get as far as I want to.
Because, you know, I think you brought up the bloody-mindedness of killing the goats and the children.
Yeah.
But you're missing a historical point. When tribes would come through and kill their enemies, they would absorb their animals and children as a bounty, because children died all the time. So big families were good, even if they were, you know, slaves really, but at that point, but they came into the household. The goats and the children came into the household. By killing them all, you didn't, you were doing it for the right reasons. You weren't just killing them and taking it in and taking the bricks of silver.
Right. Yeah, and I think, if I can mentally steal from what Skylar might be thinking. It doesn't, whether they, the tribes at the time, thought that that was the case or not, doesn't mean that that was morally okay. It only means it's morally okay. It's morally okay if and only if morality is subjective, and that subjective morality must be read in context. Now, it is the case, I think you're exactly right, you mentioned it earlier, kind of a mens rea, an intent of evil. Whether they intended to do evil or not is influenced by what their society says is evil and what is not to some degree. So I will grant you that one. So in the same way that God says where there is no law, there is no sin, that I think it makes that point more valid than I would want to make it. But by the same token, I think we all have the Spirit of God talking to us and convicting us of sin to some degree, quietly, albeit quietly in some ways. So even when they're doing so, I mean, maybe Skylar's had this experience too. You might, even under this idea that says, well, the New Testament says to be obedient to the authority, and that sometimes he uses nation to punish nation, and so if we're in America and we're fighting these bad guys, and I kill these bad guys, then I'm doing the morally right thing. And remember, notice I'm using the term bad guys here, like automatically they're bad just because. You know, that's not necessarily the case, or we're all bad at some point. But at some point, I looked around at my fellow executioners and said, one of my fellow executioners said it one time, some guy said, you know, because God's on our side or whatever else. And he was like, really? These guys pray like 5 times a day. How often do you pray? So I don't think I'd appeal to God on that one. And this guy was an atheist. He wasn't saying it from some morally righteous position. He was just being like, you're inconsistent here. And so I think that point is something that is important to consider, is even when you are, and you know, the executioner ought to swing his axe and be like, there but for the grace of God, go I as well.
You start to enjoy it,
yeah,
and you're doing it wrong.
And you're doing something.
I also think another argument against yours that is, you're implying that sin is static. And I believe God is static, but the type of sin is not always static. There are sins that he's defined before, but there are sins that have come up. So as we've grown in our intelligence and in the way, you know, in our society and things, I believe that there are differences in because of the intent issue. You know, there are things that are sin today that were not sins before, and there are sins before that are not sins today. There are fundamental sins that are always the same.
It's an issue. Skylar.
Lot to unpack. So something like, we would decry, Christians in society in general would decry genocide now.
Sure.
But in the Old Testament, no. It was not a sin in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Okay. There's probably no point in discussing that because we are not going to.
Slavery is a better one. Slavery was practiced
with.
Was practiced, not racial slavery, I'm talking about non-racial slavery.
Yeah.
From the beginning of time, slavery has been in every society.
Yeah, let's grant that. Slavery, it was part of the society.
It's an easier one than genocide. So until recently, hundreds of years, it was always non-racially connected.
But it was always wrong. In every encapsulation, the ownership of one human being by another is immoral and wrong.
And I would disagree. At different times, it was not. Because think about if I was a... So the Justinian Christian Romans, right?
Yep.
So I went out and I conquered the Gauls. I brought them in to Rome as slaves. Now, the only difference really between a worker and a slave is the band on their neck, but they ate the same, whatever, but at the end of the day, they all became Christians and went back to Gaul and changed Germany into a Christian nation. So, was it wrong? It was wrong if the intent was to harm them in slavery. If the intent was not to harm them, but just to give them, you know, possession, that was the way society was built. They didn't have any concept of money. They didn't have any concept of individual freedoms, or in fact, there was no such thing as individualism. So the answer is no, it wasn't always wrong to be slavery. That's just the way society was built.
Say slavery was not always wrong.
The way their society was built.
All right, so let's leave that one out there for 1 second. Okay. So slavery, here's one side. Slavery was not always wrong. Skylar, not that I'm supporting this point, a separate question. What do you mean by ownership? Because you define slavery in terms of ownership.
I mean slavery as defined in its simplest terms of owning another human being is immorally wrong and has been since the dawn of time.
Yes, but my question is, what do you mean by ownership?
Oh my gosh.
What do you mean by that? Because your boss owns you. Your boss.
My boss does not.
No. That's what I'm trying to get to. What is your definition of ownership?
He owns a portion of you. You've sold it to him.
My boss does not.
You do.
Well, hold on. Let's let him answer the question. What do you mean by ownership?
What do I mean by ownership?
Yeah.
The control and the control of another human being's life and status and freedom of movement and choice. Within complete freedom of movement and choice within their life. I don't know. It seems like don't have to define this.
Okay.
Because we all know what it means.
Okay, so let's say something like that. Now my question is this.
Scott, come on.
Yep.
Don't be ridiculous.
No, I don't mean to be ridiculous.
You are being ridiculous.
Well, I haven't made the point yet, so wait to ridicule me after I make the point. If you're going to say that this level of control is, let's say, total control, that is to say, American 1820 slavery, I don't like the way this guy's face looks, I'm going to kill him. All right? That's total control.
Property.
Right? True property, as in I can also light my property on fire if I want to and nobody can tell me boo. So whether that was or wasn't, the bottom line is, let's say that and we say that level of control is wrong. That's not okay. Now, why is that level of control not okay? Well, that one spoke to the right to take a life. So what if we bind control to say control of another human being's life, life in life, not the authority to take life, but in life. So now you get to tell them everything that they're going to do and they have to obey you, or you're going to do something to them. Now, what you can say is, well, the something to them may include whipping them. It may include, shackling them and keeping them in wherever. But basically what we're talking about is corporal punishment okay? Is confinement okay? Because both of those are practiced in parent-child relationships, at least today. Now, the question simply I'm pointing out, Skylar, is that becomes a matter of degree. You're drawing, the definition's the same. It's control of a human being's life. The question is, to what degree is that permissible? Okay. And now, the parent-child thing is, at some point, the child in our society hits 18 and they can walk and do whatever they want. A slave never would hit that point unless let go by their master. In ancient Israel, they did hit that point every 7 years. It was automatic. You get free. So, all I mean to say is, if you're talking about, I think we can all agree that the slavery that was practiced in America was wrong. Now, the question is are all forms of control, of ownership, of control over a human being wrong? And we can all agree that the answer is no. They're not all wrong, because a parent-child relationship isn't a wrong relationship. That's somehow reasonable and dutiful and morally okay.
Governance
and all that kind of stuff. Now the question is, where in that spectrum does it lie? The word slavery complicates the matter. The word control, I think, is the heart of the matter, because at the end of the day, slavery is about control. And I just mean to point that out, and I'm not trying to erode the definition at all. I'm trying to sharpen what the definition is, because at the end of the day, sharpening that definition will bring the debate to a point where we can agree this is how you define where control is within the limits of morally good and where control exceeds the limits of morally good. Yes, ma'am.
So the parent-child slave or control relationship breaks down a little bit in that teenage girl can go get an abortion without permission of her parents. The law can take a child away from their parents if they're not treating them appropriately. So there is that parent-child control, but there's also within a parameter where we don't really see that with slavery. With slavery, you had total control.
Well, now here's some points. Skylar's made some points like this in the past. In reality, that doesn't say that the person is not in control. What it says is the owner changes, right? The government says you can own your kids. I'm going to use owner. You can own your kids unless you do certain things, in which case we're going to step in and own your kids. That's what the government says. Now, we might argue that the government's not right to do so, or they are right to do so, or whatever else. And Skylar rightfully balks at the term ownership, because ownership implies a total control where you own all the rights of the thing. So that's why I asked you for your definition of. So I would add, Skylar, to the definition that you're really using, you mean this.
You can only whip your slaves on certain days. You're right. I've changed my belief. You're right. Slavery was okay.
I can
only whip them on Tuesdays.
Skylar's point, if I could add something to what you were saying to make your definition fit the definition that he's using, so using his definition, is you're saying ownership here is total control of another human being. And the bottom line is, we don't agree total control is correct. Parental control is not total control. Parental control is bounded control. Now the question is, who controls the controls? All right, that's a question. Who gives the parent the right to, why is it right to control your child to some point, but it's wrong to control them past that point? Is it subjective? Can one person beat or whip their children and the other person says no, speaking strongly to them is the maximum that's allowable? That's where, and now I'm back to this point over here. This is Jesus' question. We're asking the question up here. You have to go all the way back down here to say, who can tell you whether it's okay to exert control over another human being? And the answer for the Christian is only God can tell you whether you can do that. So now the downside is, you know, he's happy with this result because what it says is, if God says slavery is okay, then slavery is okay.
Which means, then why don't we have slavery now?
Well, that, so I'm not
saying. Let's go back.
So why don't we have slavery now? Because sin changes.
No,
the difference was man decided that he was going to do racial slavery and total slavery, which was different than in any point in history. The difference, by the way, there were more European slaves in the Barbary Coast.
Yeah, yeah, but let's not debate slavery per se. Let's debate, where the question is the moral justification.
Our moral definition due to that different change.
So, you know, now this is, what problem, now I'm going to go on the, I'm going to leave attacking Skyler and go and attack this position. What's the problem with saying sin changes over time?
Because you could imply that God's changing, but that's.
Yeah, now if what you're going to say, you said earlier, God is static. And I think what you meant there, not like he doesn't move, but you mean that his holiness does not change, his love does not change, and ultimately, although his commands may change, the underlying principles of why he gives those commands do not change.
Right, like children, we grow. Society, humans have grown and changed, and you know his story is not static; it's going on.
Now I'm going to write this one off to the side because I have a particular point here that the Smith patriarch will help me with. But grow is an interesting question. Has society grown? But let's leave that for now and just say society has moved from one way of being to another way of being, and that is different than it used to be. To Skyler's point, now I'm going to reinforce Skyler's point here and say, when we call what was practiced in ancient Israel slavery, that's just not a good name for it. Because what happened was, when I'm talking about slavery, I don't mean when somebody voluntarily says, I'm going to cede, basically what the slave in ancient Egypt did, Israel did, was something very similar to saying, I want to be a child who works for you. The difference was they don't get the inheritance rights of a child. They don't get to be considered family. What they said is, I will put myself under your authority, the same level of authority that you have over your children. Now, we can argue whether that level of authority was proper, etc. But that it was a voluntary thing and it was a temporal thing. It was more like what we call being, what 200 years ago was to be an apprentice or a journeyman, you know, and graduate up to be a journeyman. It was a contract for a certain period of time and as an indentured servitude.
So why did God break the Jews free from Pharaoh if they were just indentured servants?
Because he was not treating them as indentured servants. Instituted in Israel, and so I'm saying the indentured servitude in Israel, now we're using the terms properly, maybe I made it this way. If indentured servitude in Israel differed control-wise from total control that the Egyptians had, there's too many of you, kill all the boys, to the indentured servitude of the Israelite. If he treats a slave a certain way, the slave went free, or you know whatever else. There were penalties for taking the life of a slave and all that stuff. At the end of the day, we've got to be able to answer the question, not just in the slavery one, which is very poignant, but also this one. Why did Moses give a certificate to the divorcees? And the answer was, God doesn't like that answer. This is how he designed it. But he allowed you to do this because your hearts were hard. So the question is, does sin change? Or does God merely say, I'm going to limit sin in various ways? All right, that's a debate that we could go on for a very long time. So I don't think that we'll resolve this here.
Oh, I assure you we will.
But I mean to say this. When you ask these kinds of questions, I merely point out that depending on how you define it, slavery, indentured servitude, voluntary submission to authority, non-voluntary. And by the way, to Skyler's point, not everybody that was a slave in Egypt was a volunteer slave.
Right.
Canaanites. Didn't get an option about that one. It was a done deal. So, you know, that's something that's going to be an upside to his argument that somebody arguing against it has got to come up with a solution to. But if the solution is God changes what is sin over time, then you've at least got to be able to answer how that happens in a way that doesn't imply that God is inconstant. And again, we will hit this topic in greater degree elsewhere, but I bring it up only to point this stuff out. One thing that we can agree on in total is this. The world's jacked up, and there's a lot of evil in it. we agree that God ought not be a part of that evil. That is to say, he's not the source of it, but he is the redeemer of that which has been tainted by evil. He is the one who's looking to extinguish evil in the long term. He gets to be the thumb in this case. And at the end of the day, the reduction of evil and the increasing of righteousness, of holiness, is part of his goal. Okay, let's at least agree on that one. Then that will take us into what we will discuss next week, which is, how does this comport with God's love? If God really loves us, then how is it that there's all this jacked up stuff going on, and how is it that he gives these commands, or that he gives these, outlines these institutions? If he loves people, why would he do things this way, and how do those two things work together? And so when we talk about God's love in great detail next time, we will want to compare, contrast, and figure out how it integrates with God's justice. Because one of the points we'll make next time, just as a teaser trailer to it, is if God loves so completely, but he also is so just, the doctrine that comes out of this, and by the way, I think is misapplied and misinterpreted frequently, is God loves the sinner but hates the sin. When you understand his justice and his love perfectly together, you can understand this. Parents understand some of this already. You know, when your kid does something that you're like, you're angry at that which is done. But if someone said, do you not love your child? You'd say, don't be ridiculous. Don't be absurd. I love them very much. And in fact, one of the reasons I'm so angry is that I love them so much. If this was some other kid that I didn't care about doing this stuff, what makes me angry is that I want this kid to be happy and to do the right things, and here I'm watching them do the wrong things, and that's upsetting to me. So the anger of God is the borderline, is what comes from the borderline in some way of the touching of his justice and his love, if and only if there's evil. If there's no evil, there's no conflict between God's justice and love. And the ultimate goal of society is to be a place where there is no anger for God, because the twin properties of God, of being all holy, all just, and being all loving, have no conflict in the society, because there is nobody there who is not also acting lovingly and acting justly. And if you want to ask the question of how do we ensure that we act justly, the secret to it isn't figure out how to be perfectly just. Interestingly, the secret is figure out how to be perfectly loving. Because if all parties are loving each other maximally, there will be no conflict in justice. Period. Easy. Simple. Because everybody abandons their rights and gives them to the other person or yields them to God. That's the interesting thing. The one thing that I would say in support of the idea of slavery, not the way we practice it, is this.
Okay, please go on.
Yes.
The one thing I would say in support of the idea of slavery, continue.
Yes, is this.
Make sure I capture the first part of that sentence.
There's only one authority that is worthy of being rendered all of your rights. The slavery is either losing your rights to somebody else or freely rendering them to somebody else.
No. I don't think you can make yourself a slave.
Okay, can I volunteer to be entirely under your authority? Can I say this to you, Skyler?
In this plane of existence, I should say, in the physical plane of existence, I do not think that you can make yourself a slave.
Here is a possible example. Tell me where it breaks down. Skyler, this is not a legal contract. I'd like to say this is an academic exercise only.
Right.
I would yield myself to you, property, life, body, the whole thing. You want to beat me, you can beat me. You want to take my property and use it for your own, you can do that. You want to take my life, I give you the rights, that whatever rights I own to those, just me, right? Not God, not the society. And by the way, we've moved off into some island where there's no sovereign authority of another nation.
Somalia.
There's no sovereign authority, period.
Right.
And I say, I will work for you 100%. I give you that. Now, if you may say, I find it morally reprehensible that you'd even make the offer, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
Okay, you didn't accept my offer of being a slave. But if you said, I'll accept that. If you said, I'll accept that, am I not now a slave to you?
No.
You just tokenized the word.
No.
No, why not?
Because I cannot take away, in this kind of arbitrary, imaginary place.
Yes.
The only law that you have, that is implicit in your offer, is that you cannot take it away. You cannot revoke your offer. Yeah. You said that this society has no law, so you're free to revoke your offer of being my slave whenever you want.
Agreed. But my point is, from a will, I got so excited I had to stand up. If I willfully continue that relationship, have I not willed myself into the position of being a slave?
You are never a slave because you always have the power to take that back. Even if you never do, you're not a slave because you always have the power to walk away.
Okay. So here's the idea, though. Well, hold on. Here's the idea. Let me take Skylar's definition as on its face value. I present myself as a slave to you.
Sure.
And I say, I will obey everything that you say. And what you say is, okay, I'll give you orders. I'll do all these other things. But at the end of the day, you're not a slave. Now, let's say you're actually a really good dude, and everything that you tell me to do is good, not only for you, but it's actually good for me in the long run. You know, so even the, you have me, you're like, great, terrific. Go tend these fields. Go tend my garden. Go help me build these things. And at the end of building all these things, you then at some point say to me, I appreciate you thinking you're a slave the whole time. I've never thought of you as a slave. I'll tell you what I actually thought of you as, a son. All of these things are yours. All the work you've done for me was building your future, your mansions, your things. Okay, so the idea is, in my mind, I have subserviated myself to you, but because you are so good, all the stuff that you made for me, that you made ostensibly for yourself, was stuff that you, out of largesse, handed right back to me, making me a son instead of a slave. This is the idea of Christianity. That's all I mean to say.
I'm totally with you.
Okay, good. Violent agreement. I love it.
Right.
Okay.
Christianity out of Somalia.
Yeah, out of Somalia, yeah. Not the place you would have thought it was started. Okay. I wanted to say one thing about grow because I just love this point and you happen to be here. This will be the last thing I say. We say our society has, and I'm not picking on you, everybody says this. I've said this. Our societies grow. The question is, and we say progress, and sometimes we mean certain things when we say that, and sometimes we argue with it. If somebody builds a house and you watched them do it. Let's say you got to watch them do it, or they showed you photos afterward of how they did it. And the ratio of concrete that they mixed for the foundation was completely wrong. Way too much aggregate, way too little cement. They didn't compact the dirt under half of it. They compacted the dirt under the other half. When they framed it up, the framing nails they used were ones that are going to slide out in X amount of time and rust and come apart. And the angles of the trusses were all wrong. And the house is up and standing. And so people will say, look at how much we've built. What would you, and let's say that portions of it, the doors were all framed properly. The windows were put in the right way. The flooring was laid down decently on a subfloor that's not decent. And the shingling was done without tar paper. But it was done properly minus that thing. So there here are five or six different things that were done by the book. What would you say about that house? What's the right thing to do to the house?
Yeah, it's unsound, tear it down.
You've got to tear the whole thing down. So the fact that we have things in society and we're like, but look at the technology or look at the moral movement, the positive moral movement. We used to have African slaves here. We don't do that anymore. That's positive moral movement. That's like, well, I put the roof on right. I laid the floor down. Who cares about the subfloor? I laid the floor down properly. Didn't I lay the floor down properly? Yes, you lay the floor properly. But the bottom line is it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because the foundation is rotten. It will come down over time. This is why Rome fell. This is why, God willing, it will be a long time until we do, but we'll fall. Is you cannot build a house on a foundation that is morally corrupt. And we'll get to that point. This is not a political statement. I mean, it's to use this as a statement about humanity, not about USA. I love America. I fought for America. I would die for America. But it ain't all clean. The kingdom of God is simply about don't build anything that God doesn't direct you to build and make sure the foundation is solid. And by the way, the cornerstone has to go off of this, right? The cornerstone has to go off of this. Yes, it is. That's Peter. Peter Dixon. Yes, Peter, you're exactly right. That is Hey, you know what? Hey, Air Force, I got news for you. In the Marine Corps, it felt like voluntary slavery. No, you're right. It's not the same. Okay. This was a terrific discussion. Thank you for participating as vehemently as you have. Next time we talk all about love, this will be my favorite one because I love talking about God's love. It's the ultimate quality. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your participation. We'll see you next week, God willing.